Good morning. Right now, push back the table, strap on a hard shoe, maybe do some stretches, hamstrings, glutes. Headband, optional. It is still spine-chilling Riverdance, and if you take yourself back to 1994, it was the interval act for the Eurovision and a game changer.
It was in front of millions of people, and it was so distinctively Irish, but also I think it triggered descriptions of words that you wouldn't necessarily have associated with being Irish in 1994, words like modern, dazzling, glamorous, sexy, young, good-looking, stylish.
John O'Regan from Reeling in the Years with Oliver and bringing some of that sexy and stylish, Jean Butler and Michael Flatley. Bowman on Sunday brought us the two on The Late Late.
As an audience, I remember, I was there on the point for the Eurovision, of course, and I remember the, I thought, first of all, the immediate stand-up ovation you got must have knocked you both to the back of the stage. Did it feel like that to you?
Well, it certainly did to me. I was overwhelmed. Mm. I think, if you'd have closed your eyes and not even been able to hear the applause, you would have felt something from that audience. It was really powerful.
And did you feel that during the dance, or are you thinking so busily of other things?
I think during the dance, you could feel it. I mean, you couldn't not feel it, actually. When I went off stage after my solo and coming back on, there was an actual lift, and I heard, actually, a few people in the corner who I was close to kind of go, woo! Yeah. So you can feel it, and that built the end as well for us as performers.
Yeah, it's extraordinary that one item like that should make such an impression on so many people. It was a marvellous moment.
And if you are wondering how they got the drums of those steps so precisely on the night, the Darcy, indiscreet.
I was lucky enough to be there that night, and I remember there was a huge lead up because I was working in here at the time, and everybody was talking about this interval act and the major problems miking the shoes, because if they weren't exactly on time, it would sound a little bit like a cacophony and all over the place and discordant. So what they did was, and I can say this because it's 30 years on, isn't that the statutes of limitation and all that sort of thing, that they actually recorded them in a studio, in sync. And what you heard at home when you were watching Riverdance as the Eurovision act at halfway or halftime was a recording. So they hadn't got the mics on the shoes that night. They had recorded in a studio, and that's why it sounds so synchronous and so amazing.
Riverdance. And if we were ever to need a new national anthem. Migration front and centre of the news this week, and the Irish and British governments became embroiled in a terse exchange over their respective migration policies. In particular, the controversial Conservative Rwanda policy and the subsequent increase in asylum seekers crossing into the Republic from Northern Ireland. This clip from Tory MP Jacob Rees-Mogg might just stop you in your tracks.
What this news really presents is a golden opportunity. An opportunity to send all of the illegal migrants in the UK to facilities near the Irish border. If it just so happens that they then end up crossing the border, which, according to the Belfast Agreement, must remain open, and indeed our departure from the European Union agreement, so be it. According to the Irish courts, they're happy to take in all the poor refugees fleeing persecution. There is an army barracks that's apparently facing redevelopment, and we're using other military facilities in the rest of the UK, and Northern Ireland's a fundamental part of the UK. It can do its bit, and it can house some migrants, which can then be sent over to the Republic, where they'll be wonderfully safe, as opposed to this dangerous land that they tried to get into in the first place. This would have many advantages. It would keep the cost of Rwanda down, as fewer people would need to be sent there. And the EU would be so happy because it would fulfil its beloved human rights obligations, and the Irish government could feel a sense of superiority to His Majesty's government.
Nothing if not provocative, Jacob Rees-Mogg. And according to UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, this policy was working. And here, Justice Minister Helen McEntee put the figure close to 90% on asylum seekers entering Ireland from Northern Ireland, although that figure has been disputed. And of course, behind these statistics, people. But what exactly was the legal situation? On Monday's Drive Time, Sarah put this to David Leonard, barrister with expertise in asylum and immigration.
So it's expected a memo is going to be brought to Cabinet tomorrow by the Justice Minister, Helen McEntee, outlining this legal fix that, in essence, will enable Ireland to send asylum seekers back to the United Kingdom. Firstly, is that possible in your view, that legal fix?
It's certainly possible to fix the legal issue that arose from a judgment from the High Court last month. But just because the government can fix the law to make it legally possible as a matter of Irish law to send people back to the UK if they've travelled through the UK to claim asylum here, even if it's fixed legally, the Irish state will be able to send asylum seekers back to the UK only if the UK consents to that.
OK, so if we see there Rishi Sunak saying he's not interested in a deal with the Irish government to accept asylum seekers back from Ireland to the UK, that's a problem then?
It is a problem because you can fix the law, but if the government, if the UK government doesn't consent to receive people back to there, they can't be deported back because they're not UK citizens.
And the British government absolutely insistent it wouldn't be taking back any asylum seekers from Ireland. At least not while its fellow EU member state France refused to take asylum seekers back from the UK. And all of this in a week of local elections in the UK, which incidentally do not seem to be going the Conservatives' way. On Monday, a planned meeting in London between Justice Minister Helen McEntee and UK Home Secretary James Cleverly was cancelled to be rescheduled. Giving his verdict on the diplomatic goings-on, former Taoiseach Bertie O'Hearn with Clare.
And what did you think of James Cleverly's decision to cancel the meeting with Helen McEntee yesterday?
Well, I think as I understand it, the Irish officials were all, and I might be wrong on this.
No, I think that's a given. They were there the night before preparing.
I don't think that's a good idea. I can never remember actually British officials doing that on me. But anyway, I would have told them the next meeting it'll be in Kerry.
Listen, the response was that Helen McEntee then didn't travel to the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference. Was that the right call to snub them back?
Yeah, no, I think it was a right call. If she went over for a meeting and they cancelled it at short notice, she's enough to be doing it.
And then, in the early hours of Wednesday morning, a removal of the tents on Dublin's Mount Street that had been home to asylum seekers. Here's Kate Farley on Morning Ireland.
Part of Mount Street in Dublin 2 is closed off this morning to traffic and pedestrians, and we can see a large Garda presence in place. And we can also see people packing up their belongings from the tents in the area. There are at least 5 buses waiting to take them away.
Over 200 people were relocated to alternative accommodation at City West and the Crooksling tented accommodation site. Later that day on the News at 1, Brian spoke to the Minister for Integration, Roderick O'Gorman.
We have arrivals now running at, it's dozens per day, isn't it? I think the latest figures had average daily arrivals of 54, 378 people arriving in that particular week, which was the week, I think, ending the 21st of April. Is all this not just going to recur again?
Well, we are under very significant pressure, and we've seen a number of weeks where we've been in the mid-400s in terms of arrivals. And that's why it is important that my department can continue to bring on additional accommodation, both for families, but also for male applicants as well. As you know, at the end of March, we published the Comprehensive Accommodation Strategy, which sets out steps A, to deal with the kind of immediate challenges we face in terms of being able to bring on, more basic levels of accommodation quickly, but secondly wants us to move away from a system where we're so dependent on commercial providers and provide a core of 14,000 state-owned beds going forward, so the state has much more control over the location and the costs of international protection.
And on Thursday, the government launched its new initiative to rent or buy buildings to house asylum seekers. Fianna Fáil's Paul McAuliffe spoke to Clare.
But what's happened today doesn't say a measured and, you know, responsible, a new approach. This tender's going to give me your property, quick, whatever you have, we'll take it.
Well, now, with respect, Claire, I read the tender. It doesn't say anything about give us your properties quick. I think that's alarmist. It looks for partnerships with property owners and with people to provide turnkey facilities. I think that's a totally different thing. I think that's the state moving towards a more permanent solution to asylum claims.
And private developers, building contractors who are interested in selling or leasing existing properties, buildings in Turkey to condition existing properties that require upgrading, refurbishment, renovation. That's a fairly desperate call to the private sector for property, any sort of property.
Well, given it's closed to tenders next April, I don't know how you can apply the word desperate.
Listen, you were told a long time ago to build reception centres. There is no plan. There isn't one site that has been publicly identified. I've asked the Taoiseach, I've asked countless ministers, and I'm asking you today, and nobody can tell us where these things are or where the plan is.
Absolutely clear. The plan is being developed. There's no published plan at this point. And as I say, how that plan is communicated and how communities are consulted and brought with, I think is really, really important because, as I say, we're moving away from an emergency response and we have to do that. And we have to respond in the way that we did because of the increased numbers. But given that we're going to be given this level of people coming to Ireland claiming asylum, we have to move to a more permanent system.
I just don't see how you can say that this tender isn't part of an emergency response. It is.
Well, it's part of the government's response to process asylum claims and to house people while we do that. Absolutely. And that's what the tender says.
Fianna Fáil TD Paul McAuliffe with Clare. And on Thursday's 6 o'clock news, this.
Up to 100 men seeking asylum who gathered outside the International Protection Accommodation Services office in Dublin today have been told there was no available accommodation. Some had been queuing since early this morning. The men were told there would be no further offers of accommodation due to a shortage and were provided with a list of homeless services. The US President Joe Biden.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. If you're planning on heading to the cinema this weekend, you might be thinking of going to see The Fall Guy.
It's based on the character from the 80s, a Lee Major character from the 80s. You know, the TV show that used to be on every Saturday morning.
Yeah, but when I heard Lee Majors, I thought, surely the $6
million man. What are they thinking?
Whose music is in the midst of our theme tune somewhere, and I always love doing the slow motion running.
Well, there is actually, there's a 10 second audio reference to that in the film.
Yeah.
In the middle of one complex fight, it goes, you get that noise that you got whenever he
jumped,
did something very strong or very fast.
He jumped an open drawbridge. He jumped an open drawbridge.
In this film?
Tarzan from a Vine.
That's right.
And the unknown stuff.
The Maid Eastwood looks so fine. That duet with Arlene Hunt on Arena. But this film stars Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling, both beautiful and rather fabulous. What could possibly go wrong?
The core of the piece is they're going for a kind of screwball thing. They're going going back through Romancing the Stone, back to His Girl Friday and so forth. And I got a real sense of awful desperation in the performance, as if they're trying really, really hard to get this chemistry going that's not there. The dialogue is overlapping. They're firing it out almost quicker than you can hear, as indeed would Cary Grant have done in His Girl Friday. And there's even a hint of improvisation, though that may be my imagination because the dialogue is so thin, I'm assuming it must be improvised. It could be written down on the page. And none of that really makes that chemistry work. I mean, it's as if they're working with inert material and it just never really fires up.
OK. Get off that fence, Donald Clark. And as for that elusive chemistry...
They're only short of punching each other in the shoulder and calling each other bro, you know.
Yeah.
It's just not sexy.
And a terrible, embarrassing thing going on throughout this where they use this kind of supposedly clever postmodern techniques to make excuses for the screenplay. So there's one point at which they say, talking about the film within a film, it's like, well, it has no third act, and never mind, it'll be fine, we'll work it out in post or whatever, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
There's all that kind of self-deprecation running the way through. There's, you know, it's... Which is
the split screen.
Exactly. There's a point at which some point she says, let's do it in split screen, and it becomes split screen. And all this kind of self-referential stuff, but that doesn't make up for the fact that at its core, you've got a story that doesn't work, yeah. Dialogue that is flat, and a MacGuffin that is hard to even identify as a MacGuffin. I don't know what this film is about.
This is not going to end well.
Stars from you, Arlene?
I gave it 3 out of 5 because as dodgy as the plot was, at least it entertained me to the end.
I'm going no higher than 2, Sean. Thought it was rubbish. But it has got tremendously good reviews coming out of South by Southwest and Austin, so do take our word for it. We're brilliant. But but if you think we're wrong, don't blame us. We welcome all opinions.
From Arena. Crime novelist Jo Spain has a new book out. It is called The Trial, and she has written 13 novels since 2015, so a lot to talk about plotting craft. But given that she also writes the TV series Harry Wilde, starring Jane Seymour, we'll go here.
Come here, enough of this writing process. What's Jane Seymour's mansion in Malibu?
The important stuff.
Was this our kind of a rap party thing, or was it come over and we'll chat about writing?
We're friends now. We're really friends because she's a Hollywood A-lister, and I had a certain expectation going in that she would, you know, just be a Hollywood A-lister. Mm. She's very normal and she's very kind and friendly, and her attitude puts a lovely presence on set. Like, it kind of makes the set a really happy place because there's no egos allowed, because if the top star doesn't have an ego, you can't really have an ego.
That's
underneath
a really
her.
Good point, yes.
Yeah, so she creates a lovely atmosphere, and she just said, come on over to the house. I mean, it is very, you're over there, and at one point, I won't name names, but I was sitting there having a chat with a really nice guy. A lot of them are quite superficial, they're LA types. But this guy was really nice, and it turns out he just sold his back catalogue of songwriting for $500 million. And I'm sitting there drinking champagne, like trying not to choke, and I'm thinking, what?
Who is this? So,
I can't say. But he wrote some of the most famous songs you've ever heard.
I'll be Googling that now later on.
But before the Malibu dream house, infinity pools and the rich, they're just like you and me. Jo Spain worked for Sinn Féin, writing for An Fublak, and then as a speechwriter and political advisor to Piers Doherty. She told this quite surprising story.
Pierce was the first person I gave my first novel to. And he would, you know, I'd give Pierce a speech and he'd come back with red lines through it and say, you know, throw those 3 pages out, let's start again. Because he knows what he wants. But I gave the novel to him. I think he rang me up at 6 a.m. and said himself and the wife had sat up all night long. And he was like, this is going to be a #1 bestseller. You're leaving the office, aren't you? And I said, well, any luck, Pierce?
that was very nice. He read your first novel before it was
published. He's obsessed with crime novels himself, and Pascal O'Donoghue, obsessed with crime novels, and Pascal, who read them all as well. Yeah, they were sharing books. Yeah,
so much. They share books?
Yeah, they used to swap them in Leinster
Across
House.
The party lines.
Yeah, crime fiction just brings everyone together.
Did not see that coming. Quite heartening. Jo Spain with Oliver. With Brendan at the weekend, Salman Rushdie. His book Knife details that attack in August 2022.
It was very fast and I was a little bewildered. And then he hit me very hard. And I mean, actually, initially I thought he'd just hit me. On the jaw. Felt like being punched very hard. And what I didn't realise was that he had a knife in his hand. And then I saw the blood coming down the front of my clothing. And then I fell down, you know, and then he was on top of me, stabbing away. And I mean, I think he got in 15 blows in 27 seconds.
Did you think you were going to die when you were lying there?
Yeah, I did. I mean, absolutely. I was quite clear about it. First of all, I was very badly injured. And secondly, I could see this enormous and increasing lake of blood all around me. And I thought, quite matter-of-factly, I thought, yeah, this is probably it, you know. And the sadness was to feel that I was dying in the company of strangers, you know, that nobody I loved or who loved me was anywhere within hundreds of miles.
Amazingly, he was to recover, but with injuries that he will have to live with for the rest of his life.
The primal wound for you must be the loss of your eye. What's that like for you?
Well, it's not good. It's not easy. And it kind of upsets me every day. But my mother had this kind of mantra that she would tell us as children when we objected to certain things. And she would say, what can't be cured must be endured. And we were brought up on that line, kind of tough love line.
Mm-hmm.
But that line has always stuck in my head. And I thought, well, okay, this definitely can't be cured. The eye is gone. So deal with it. Deal with it. And I'm trying. There are things you have to relearn. Things as simple as pouring water from a bottle into a glass. You have to learn everything again. You have to learn how to walk down the sidewalk without bumping into people because you can't see them coming at you from your right. So there's an enormous amount of just everyday life that has to be rethought and relearned.
And this attack, belatedly prompted by a fatwa issued 30 years ago because of his book, The Satanic Verses, and a threat from which he felt he was finally safe. But how is he dealing with the psychological aftermath of such a violent attack, albeit from a lone attacker?
One of the things that actually puzzles me a little bit is that ever since the attack, the emotion that seems to have been missing from me is anger. Initially, there was no time for anger because I was concentrating on survival. And now I feel that if I surrender to anger, which must be down there somewhere, it's a way of dragging me back into that past of 20 months ago. And at the point at which I'm really very strongly focused on trying to move forward into the rest of my life. You know? So anger doesn't help. It weighs you down. You know?
Yeah.
And it just, it's not constructive. It's not helpful to me. You know. And at the moment, I'm focused on what's helpful to me. And he can... I mean, I just think he's in jail and that's good. That's the right place for him. And I feel that by writing this book, I've kind of written him out of my system, you know, and I don't really need to deal with him anymore.
However, he did go to the prison where his attacker is being held. And this had an effect on him, which he almost struggles to understand.
It's a very kind of banal little prison in a small country town, Chautauqua. So it's a fairly sort of uninteresting cell block with walls around it with barbed wire on them. And I was in the car park, you know, because we just parked the car outside the prison to have a look at it. So I was in the car park and completely involuntarily, it seemed, my feet began dancing. It started jigging about.
Hmm.
And Eliza was a bit, she was trying to take a picture of me. She said, would you please stop jumping up and down so I can get a picture of you? But I don't know, I just suddenly felt the urge to dance. I thought, I'm out here free in the car park and he's in there, not free, in jail. And that felt good.
Salman Rushdie with Brendan. And on Lyric, it was birthday time at 25 years. Lovely, lovely Lyric.
Lyric FM. It's 12 o'clock on Saturday, the 1st of May. This is Ireland's new national music and arts channel, Lyric FM.
Good afternoon to you. Welcome once again. This is the sort of day which makes wearing a hat a rather interesting experience. I hope you're warm and cozy wherever you are.
During the performance, I was rushing up in my monk's cassock. I was rushing up the stairs to my dressing room only to meet a real monk. He stopped dead, his mouth open, clutching his rosary and making a silent sign of the cross because he thought he'd seen the devil.
When I was chatting to you beforehand, we were talking about the building and you started to talk about the ghost.
Oh, yes.
And it took me a second or two to realize you were deadly serious.
Call it a ghost, poltergeist, what you will, but it is of the factotum of the theatre back in the 20s and early 30s, Johnny Hoy. He was the theatre, and he died
in the room above us round about 1931. And ever after that, it is a live factor in the theatre. The last voluntary worker leaving here always has to shout up to the stalls, "Good night, Johnny."
OK, let's warm up, shall we? First of all, get the bodies sorted out. We should do a stretch.
Every Wednesday night, you'll find about 140 people in the RTE Radio Centre in Donnybrook, making a variety of strange sounds.
Very nice. Blah, 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 blah.
The rhythms themselves are based on the South Indian drum syllables. Tidikitada, tukatidikitada, tukatukatidikitada, tukatukatadum, tukatukatadum. And the melodies then go in da 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 dum.
I find singing with my eyes closed, if my nose is touching the mic, I kind of. It gives me the. I know exactly where I am.
Here's the question: are you content that you have been a writer and are a writer? Out of all the things you could have been.
Oh, I am terribly content that I found that I was able to write, yeah. Because I never found anything else that I was really able to do.
Is it true that you guys were offered a big record deal?
That is true. It was like 1996 when they still offered deals like that, you know, when they were a possibility.
It's like five albums or something.
Exactly. But they, it was, you know, it's a terrible deal for the artists, really, particularly when you're youngsters and they... We weren't making very, very sort of commercial music.
Ah, Lyric. Everybody's happy place. Meanwhile, over on... We hear you, Derek. We hear you. Yes, it's on Sunday.
Blue-tit, grey-tit, cold-tit, long-tail-tit, blackbird, song-thrush, mistle-thrush, pheasant, green-finch, chaff-finch, black-headed gull, grey heron, gold-crest, chiff-chaff, willow-warbler, sedge-warbler, it goes on and on.
The Dawn Chorus, do not miss it. And that was Jim Wilson on Mooney Goes Wild. And it might beat sitting at your laptop trying to tick those boxes for the CAPTCHA. You know, the ones, the traffic lights, the pedestrian crossings. All to prove, yes, you are a human. And AI certainly can beat the CAPTCHA. However, us humans have our own tricks.
The checkbox is the most recent one. It's currently the most popular one. Basically, what pops up is a window with a checkbox in it, and you have to guide your mouse to that. And the difference between a human doing it and a bot doing it is that when we move our mouse from one place on the screen to the next, we do it like an airplane landing. We don't do a straight line. We do a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, more a little bit to the left, a little bit more to the left. So we have a squiggly route. And in that pathway of our mouse, which goes back to the CAPTCHA, that reveals that we're human. The other thing that these checkboxes do is that they also look at your browsing history for the last number of websites that you've looked at, and it is that that reveals that you're a human.
And we've given them permission to do that, have we?
Yeah, yeah. When you load that, this is part of the stuff that's gathered. This is part of your digital footprint and my digital footprint and everyone else who clicks those privacy acceptance terms and conditions when you go to a website. Mm-hmm. They can track your mouse movement. And they can track your browsing history. And that reveals you're human rather than bot.
Okay, so that answers the question that people tend to ask, you know, is my phone listening to me? No, it's not. You've told the websites everything that they need to know. They don't need to listen to you.
Claire with Professor of Computing at DCU, Dr. Alan Smeaton. Later today, rugby, Leinster versus Northampton.
Nigel, Marcus O'Buchla of Leinster Rugby, falls to Ruth Glore. What's the feeling in the camp after the captain's run today?
Yeah, the feeling's very good. It's been a good training week. A couple of niggles, unfortunately, to a couple of players. Unfortunately, Gary Ringrose and Hugo Keenan haven't come through training quite how Leo Cullen, the coaches, would have liked this week. But it's a relatively settled team from the team that accounted for the reigning champions, La Rochelle, in the quarterfinal. So, yeah, the camp is good. The mood is positive and everyone's looking forward to running out in Jones's Road in front of over 82,000 people tomorrow at 5:30.
Yeah, which is spectacular, isn't it?
However, strange days for Southsiders.
Total said, don't mention the Dart. It isn't running south, so some Leinster fans will be getting on buses for the first time in their lives. Good luck and Godspeed, fellows. What a great sacrifice that's going to be. Like, oh my God, what's a Dublin bus? It's like someone put diesel engines into the flats and drive them around town. Like, what the fox is going on the north side? It's gross, it's gross. Build a wall, bro. Leinster. Of course, they're not all like that, but that is what Russell Carroll Kelly has gifted the world, no doubt about it.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. At 9 a.m, tales of liars and near saints. First, the liar, or as he describes himself, the big, fat, filthy, disgusting liar. His name, Tom Moran, and such a filthy, disgusting liar is he that he's written a play about it. He started early. Just have a listen to this.
Yeah, so I was in school, and like loads of kids, I hadn't done my homework one day. And I was afraid of this particular teacher and I didn't want to come clean. So, you know, like loads of kids, and like I regularly did, I faked being sick to get the day off school.
Yeah.
And I picked a sore tummy because, you know, there was no scopes. They couldn't look in the ears or up the nose, anything like that.
Oh, you had it all thought out.
Oh, I had it down to a T. Yep. But on this particular day, you know, the doctor's kind of poking and prodding at my tummy. But the spot that he hits that I choose to kind of wince at, it turned out to be my appendix. So I was sent to the hospital, you know, for all these ultrasounds and all this sort of stuff. So in the car, I'm like, oh, I presume, you know, a scan is going to show I'm fine and they'll just send me
home.
You're
going to have to go.
Exactly. It'll be like, a miscommunication. It'll all be fine. But I was quite a heavy child. And so the ultrasound actually wouldn't work, as in it couldn't see through like the flab in my tummy.
Right.
So then they didn't know what was wrong and they were like, well, the spot where your pain is totally consistent with appendicitis and we really don't want it to burst. So to be on the safe side, we'll take it out. So I get this land and I'm like, but there's nothing wrong with my appendix. I'm totally fine. But I'm also in too deep at this point. And so I just let them take it out. And more to the point, I didn't tell anyone for about 20 years.
Oh my God. And at no point are you thinking along the way, like, for example, on the way to hospital, that maybe I should come clean?
Oh, the whole way. But I mean, that is the extent of my people pleasing. And I didn't want to get in trouble. It was all that very like childish stuff. If I didn't want to, you know, disappoint my parents, I didn't want to, you know, be a bad kid in school. So the easier option just lay under the knife.
Wow. Talk about dedication. Hard to beat that. Not that we are recommending that you try, children. Oh, no. That was Wednesday. On Thursday, former CEO of Spike Island, John Crotty. He has written a history book on the island. And while you might expect some criminals, you mightn't have seen little Nelly coming.
Yeah, very interesting character. She came from Waterford with her father, who was a soldier, and he was stationed on Spike Island in the early 1900s. Now, sadly for her, her mother passed away, and she herself contracted TB. But how she actually dealt with that was deemed miraculous. You know, she didn't display any pain. She was reporting visions and the like. So she actually asked to take Holy Communion, which for a child of four was just unheard of. At the time, the age of communion was 12. So yeah, she was allowed to do this, and she sadly passed. But when her story went to the Pope in Rome, he had actually been considering lowering the age of communion anyway. So when he heard the story, he went, well, that's exactly the sign I've been waiting for. So there, he lowered the age from 12 to 7. And this little Irish girl is the reason every Catholic worldwide now has their communion age 7.
The legacy of little Nelly. John Crotty with Oliver. Very interesting. Now, Liveline. It started with a book that looked at very old Irish recipes and then a call out for your food memories.
I always associate baking smells, like the smell of fresh bread, brown bread coming out of the oven, with my mother. And the smell of porter cake. She would regularly make porter cake, and that smell of Guinness and butter and raisins on the range. Even thinking about it now just takes me right back.
Oh, and that was the call out. But it being Liveline, that's not what came in. Here's Margaret. Oh, and if you're eating your breakfast, maybe hold off.
Many, many years ago, I was dating John, who ended up being my husband. And the first time he brought me to Mayo, his mother said she would cook me a treat. And she cooked lamb's tails. I had never heard it before and I never wanted to hear or eat them again, I could tell you. But one was trying to impress, and so she would take the tail and she would burn it on the gas ring to get the wool off it.
Oh.
And then I don't and then boil them and then put them on a plate. And I won't tell you what they looked like, Katie. It's a family show. But it was the most vile thing I have ever eaten.
Is it an actual, like, is this something that people in that part of the country do eat? Is this a...
Well, not anymore. And I think she was one of the last ones to do it, in fairness. But I mean, you know, when I said it to other people down there, they were like, oh, yeah, I remember having lamb's tails. I mean, I suppose waste not, want not. But, oh, my God, I'm still laughing and thinking about it and sitting there wondering, how am I going to eat this and not insult the woman, you know?
What was the consistency?
Oh, God. It was like a very grizzly boiled sausage. It was like a pale pink sausage. And the consistency was like, it wasn't like pure meat, because obviously there's a small bone in there, mm-hmm. In the tail.
Yeah.
So it was kind of rough, would be one way of putting it.
But are you, is the idea that you eat the whole thing, the bone at all?
Yes.
Or, okay. And
yes. Because there's not a lot of meat on it now, in fairness.
Yeah.
And it's boiled. I can't remember. Like, she must have boiled it for quite a while. That's the only thing I can assume. And you know, the lambs would have been quite young. But, she put, like, I think about half dozen on this plate in front of me. I will never forget looking across at my then-boyfriend for inspiration, wondering, was there a dog under the table? I could see that there was something.
Mayo's finest, Margaret, if you can't take us at our worst and all that. And then it started. Stewed testicles, mushy brains, boiling pig's heads. Veggies, vegans everywhere. Cover your ears before we dip them in sweet and sour for a nibble later. Here's Kathleen getting that water boiling.
Pig's head.
Pig's head and pig's tongue.
Oh, pig's head and pig's tongue.
Pig's tongue.
Okay, now, pig's tongue.
I grew up on a farm in Wexford, and we'd all sorts of tillage farm and animals. So we used to have pig's head, boiled pig's head and cabbage.
Yeah.
And the tongue was like the delicacy nowadays. The pig's trotter. Trotters were, you know, very tasty. And I know a lot of fat on them, but they were very tasty. You halved it.
Yeah.
My mother, yeah, you halved it and boiled it. Now, it was very salty.
Yes.
And then the tongue, it's called, with the delicacy part. Nowadays, it's a delicacy, rather.
And the tongue would be boiled separately and sliced, would it?
No, not separately. Like, you'd split the head, like half a pig's head, say, like, kind of thing.
Yes, so you'd one ear, one eye, one nostril.
Yeah.
I have a very vivid memory of this. Would you have half a tongue then if you were going that way, or the tongue would go at one half of the head?
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
And did you like it?
I did, yeah, we loved it. But sure, in those days, like when I, growing up, that time, you didn't have a choice. Like nowadays, kids are too finicky about their food and, you know, but you just had to eat it and when it's put on the table.
Oh, listen good, kids, listen good. But proving that organs an awful well, it's really how you market them. Step up connoisseur Dara. He'd travelled to Brussels and been given a tip off.
And she said, before you go home, you must go to this particular restaurant. And we had to order the speciality, which was lamb brain.
Ooh.
And we did, because we were trying to be dutiful. And the thing came out and it looked like a brain on a plate, and it was the only time in my whole life that I nearly balked. And I was with a friend who was a real meat and two veg, but because I never balked, she just said, well, I know you're going to make me eat it, so let's dig in. And it turned out to be absolutely delicious. It's all in the mind, pardon the pun.
Oh my God. So what did it taste like?
It was a slightly interesting texture, a sweetbread kind of texture. Mm-hmm. If you've ever had lamb's testicles, yes, or anything like that, you know what I mean. Kind of slightly spongy, But very tasty. Not like any other meat I can think of. Organ meat is kind of different in that regard. Now half your listeners are now passing out on the floor.
Oh, yuck. A Liveline with Katie. And a big week for the newsroom. And two voices that will be familiar to many, leaving the mothership. After 39 years in RTE, Eileen Magner is retiring. President Higgins paid tribute to the North West correspondent, RTE's very first female correspondent. And after 37 years, Brian Dobson had his last day in the office.
Before I sign off, as this is my final day on the News at One and my last day in RTE, I'd just like to take a moment, if I may, to thank the team here for making my job such a joy over the last few years. Day after day, they come up with great story ideas, with fascinating guests and with forensic questions. They make me sound good, and I'm very grateful for that. My gratitude is due also to everyone I've worked with here in RTE over 37 years on Morning Ireland, on the 6-1 News, on the 9 o'clock News, and on the very many one-off news specials, documentaries and feature programmes which I've been fortunate enough to be involved in. Broadcasting is a team game, and I've been lucky to work with some of the very best teams in this business. My appreciation also goes to the many guests I've interviewed on this and other programmes over the years, people who've told their personal stories, others who've shared their knowledge, their insights, their expertise, and those in positions of power who make themselves accountable. As I remarked earlier to the Taoiseach, it's a vital strength of our democracy that our elected representatives, the people who we choose to govern, come on the airwaves to answer for their decisions, and long may that continue. All of this, though, is with one purpose: to serve you, our audience. So thank you for listening, for watching and for engaging. I know from texts, from emails, from letters that you are well informed, you are discerning and you possess a highly developed waffle detector. Thank you for your time, your attention and your feedback. It keeps us on our toes. Lastly, my love to my family, to my wonderful wife, Kriya, to our fantastic daughters, Sophie and Hannah. They have been my motivation and my strength and my support. It's been a great 37 years, but the time has come to say, if I can borrow a phrase, that Dobbo has left the building.
Brian Dobson, who will be sorely missed, the voice of integrity. But it didn't take long to find a replacement.
Anyway, sorry, give Mr. Jingle there, OK? Now do me news. I've checked the phone. I've just actually, some breaking news. Some breaking news has just come true. So if you play the jingle.
Now, go on.
Good evening and welcome to the 4:30 news. My name is Dustin the Turkey. Some news just reaching us here in Montrose and Radio Television. Claire Burns' cacs have exploded. She was 47. House private, no flowers, please. All donations in lieu to the I shouldn't have had the third portion of spag ball. In other news, Simon Harris will get 3 wears out of his new suit this month. The Fine Gael inauguration, meeting Michael D. Higgins up in the park to be confirmed as the new Taoiseach, and his confirmation, which is happening this Sunday in Greystones, near Clucalea. Sport, there is none. That's it. It's that simple, right?
Yeah. Well, you see, it's not because...
I'm going to miss Claire Byrne.
Yeah.
Great kisser.
There's more to it than that. You have to question politicians. You have to know about everything. You know, you have to know if they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes and push the questioning. You have to do all that.
Are we still talking about Claire Byrne kissing?
No. We're talking about being...
Oh, Dobbo, yeah. Look, I always got on with Dobbo. He's one of the good guys he was. I mean, remember him walking around with the red braces, right?
Yes.
15 years after they went out of fashion. looking like a clown. And the newsroom did a fundraiser for him. Because he did some really, really dangerous reports. I remember once he did the... I think it was the Red Line Lewis. And he travelled a couple of stops on it. Now, there's not a lot of people, you know, who put themselves in that risk, you know. And there was very few security with them. Yeah. But you see, there's the other side of Dobbo, right?
Right.
Like, because when I hang around with him, like, and we used to go to the Aslan gigs together and Skipknot. Dobbo, the Yabbo, we used to call him. He got us, he's barred from 7 of the 10 Wetherspoons in Ireland. Like, you know, so what's he going to do now he's retired? We can't go anywhere with him nearly, you know?
So many libels. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.